From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we go back to a March 2018 profile of New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern by Good Weekend senior writer Amanda Hooton. In the 2 years since that cover story was printed, Ardern has risen to every dramatic challenge faced by her nation, from the Christchurch mosque shootings to the coronavirus pandemic. Today, Amanda will be joined by Katrina Strickland, the editor of Good Weekend, along with political and international editor Peter Harcher. But first, actor Sarah Bishop will read the story in full, so sit down and have a listen to The Big Challenges Facing New Zealand PM Jacinda Ardern.
On a cool, grey morning in Wellington, in the doorway of her office on the ninth floor of Parliament, the 25th Prime Minister of New Zealand is looking about as worried as anyone with her famously enormous smile is capable of. "I'm so sorry, I've given you nectarine hand," says Jacinda Ardern a moment after shaking hands. "I was just eating one, and you know how the juice goes everywhere. But anyhow, welcome." Wiggling her fingers, she leads the way into her office, a big room with a curving wall of windows. She takes a seat at a large wooden desk and begins detangling a pair of headphones while examining a pink T-shirt with the words Right Honourable Splora written on it. Splore is a groovy annual music festival near Auckland. Ardern has attended several times. "I'd better not strip and put this on," she says reluctantly. "Did her partner Clark Gayford, a TV fishing show presenter, get a T-shirt too?" asks her social media editor, setting up camera gear. "Yes," says Ardern. "Something to do with fishing. I can't remember. But mine is better." "I'm not supposed to be bothering Ardern. I have permission to shadow her here in New Zealand for 2 days, with an interview only at the end. And at this point, my assigned media person begins to usher me out of the room." Ardern turns. "You can stay longer while I do my boring rattle-off thing, if you like." She smiles. She spends the next 10 minutes doing a series of unscripted, perfect first-time clips for social media. Then, obviously changing her mind, she pulls her dark floral shift dress off. She's wearing a modest black slip underneath. But still, I'm glad I'm not Charles Woolley. She puts on the pink T-shirt, then records a welcome to Splore. Smiling into the camera, she apologises that she can't be present in person and says she's looking forward to seeing someone dressing up in a brown wig, Labour rosette and pregnancy gut. So, fruit juice? Partial strip, self-parody? We've heard a great deal about Ardern since she became Prime Minister in October 2017. But clearly there's more to the world's youngest elected head of government than meets the eye. In October 2017, Jacinda Ardern performed a political miracle. Amid an international climate of disastrous defeats for social democratic politics, the US, UK, France and Italy had all rejected their centre-left parties in the previous 18 months alone. This 37-year-old woman led the New Zealand Labour Party to victory after almost a decade in the political wilderness, having taken over the leadership less than 8 weeks earlier. Ardern had been an MP for 9 years, but had no ministerial experience. Yet after a 54-day campaign, characterised by the slogan, "Let's do this," she did it. She got Labour to within 10 seats of the centre-right National Party, which had been in power for 3 three-year terms, almost all of them under John Key before his resignation in December 2016 when Bill English took over. Then, because neither major party held a majority of seats, she conducted weeks of coalition negotiations that, against all expectations, snatched electoral victory. She was meeting with the Greens in one room and Nationalist Party New Zealand First in the other, and she kept both partners in the tent talking, recalls Annette King, former Labor deputy leader and 30-year political veteran who was on the negotiating team. And don't forget, they were talking to the National Party as well. She was moving from room to room, morning and afternoon, day after day. She had to hold in her mind exactly what she was negotiating. You can't make a promise to one party and then renege on it with another. It was a massive feat, and she led it all. Along with negotiating skill, Ardern had charisma on her side. She's one of those intensely likable people that almost everybody, well, likes. As David Farah, a right-wing pollster, blogger, and ex-National Party staffer, so theoretically not a Jacinda fan, puts it, Jacinda herself is very warm, very genuine, very comfortable in her own skin. Charisma matters everywhere, of course. But perhaps it matters more in a place such as New Zealand, where the population is only 4.7 million, roughly equivalent to that of Sydney, and where the GDP is significantly less than that of Melbourne, approximately $240 billion to Melbourne's $300 billion in 2016. Perhaps because of its size, it's a place whose leaders have a history of being approachable figures. New Zealanders do have this strange love affair with their leaders, agrees Radio New Zealand political commentator Matthew Hooton. John Key was enormously popular, 80% approval ratings for most of his 8 years in power, in a way that irritated the hell out of true red believers. But so was Helen Clark. And now Jacinda is very, very popular, incredibly so, and irritating all the dyed-in-the-wool blue people. It does make you think, come on people, we're supposed to be a little more sceptical, in the interests of democracy. Certainly, every time I go somewhere with Ardern, whom the entire country seems to call by her first name, there's a feeling that can only be described as giddy. Grown men and women smile and laugh when they see her. They rush up for selfies. They clutch their hearts with excitement. They hug her, often, and hold her hand. At the first event I attend, the opening of a building at Victoria University in Wellington, someone gifts her a grey onesie for the baby she's having with Gayford in June. Someone else helps her hold a Tuatara lizard, which looks like a miniature Komodo dragon. He may bite. I can see the worried handler mouthing. Predictably, the lizard relaxes in Ardern's hands, legs dangling. Personal charm aside, the political difficulty for opponents of Ardern is that she's promised to be, if not all things to all people, then at least a lot of things to most. She formed government on the 26th of October 2017 in coalition with New Zealand First and with a confidence and supply arrangement with the Greens. She immediately announced the cornerstones of her policy, including an ambition to slash New Zealand's child poverty levels from 15% to 5% within a decade, which, if achieved, would put New Zealand on par with the lowest levels in the OECD. She wants to make tertiary education free, lower the cost of housing by banning foreign residential investment and building affordable homes, raise the minimum wage, repair infrastructure, and combat mental illness and climate change. But she's also pledged to reduce immigration, increase trade, control government spending, and maintain ambitious debt reduction targets, all issues dear to conservative hearts. She's already achieved parts of some of these things. Using primarily the money saved by scrapping the National Party's proposed $1.5 billion New Zealand dollars a year tax cuts, she's made the first year of tertiary education free, announced an $890 million families package, raise the minimum wage from $15.75 to $16.50 an hour, driven the legislative process of banning foreign residential property investment, and begun an affordable house building scheme. In February 2018 polls, Labor rocketed to 48%, up 11% from its election result, and overtook the National Party on 43%. Ardern herself was more than twice as popular as preferred PM than the Nationals' Bill English, who has since resigned, replaced by the young, good-looking Simon Bridges. These figures are certainly a proof of Ardern's popularity, but they're also a pointer to the genuine problems facing New Zealanders. Long viewed by Australians as an unspoilt wilderness full of rugby union-playing social progressives, the reality of life in modern New Zealand includes unswimmable rivers and environmental degradation, a housing and homelessness crisis that has record numbers of people begging and sleeping in cars, significant problems in Maori and Pacific Islander communities, and some of the greatest incarceration levels, plus the highest youth suicide rate in the developed world. This comes as a surprise to many who have watched New Zealand's economy recover under John Key post-GFC, with an average annual GDP growth rate of 3% for the past 5 years, and a budget in hearty surplus thanks to drivers such as dairy and meat exports, tourism and population growth, including, since 2015, more Australians jumping the ditch than New Zealanders. New Zealand has been, by and large, very well governed for 30 years, explains Matthew Hooton. We moved into surplus in about the mid-1990s under Helen Clark and basically stayed there through the 2000s. Public debt was almost completely paid off before the GFC and the earthquake. And despite borrowing very significantly through those crises, the country's books are still sound. The New Zealand people just insist upon prudent financial management. If she wants to hold on to power, Ardern must maintain this record. This means finessing complex issues. A major source of river pollution, for instance, is the dairy industry. But clean rivers are essential to tourism, as well as being an emotional touchstone for New Zealanders. She must reassure a domestic business community worried by proposed industrial relations and tax reforms and rising wages. She must also sustain and improve New Zealand's international trade relationships. She signed the revised Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal in February 2018. And she must shore up its position as a small but very successful open economy. Thanks to its exposure to Asian markets, the size of New Zealand's economy has grown at rates far above most of the developed world, around 20% over the past decade, compared with 16% in the US and 8% in Europe. None of this lends itself to sexy speechmaking, of course, but it's a requirement to pay for the big spend domestic social policies on which she was elected. She's inherited a very healthy set of financial accounts, says Hooton. So she has money to spend, but she's left herself absolutely nothing to spare, so the fiscal situation is extremely tight. That's where the problems will come. There'll be huge pressure from the public service, for instance, for pay rises, which the government simply will not be able to meet. Hooton describes himself as right-leaning. But even Ardern's true believers recognise that the task ahead is complex. At dinner with friends in Wellington, the restaurateur comes over to express his incredible relief at Ardern's election. A retired Solicitor General of New Zealand twists around from the next table to declare she absolutely has the gravitas to be a successful leader. She understands the system, he says. She understands what she can and cannot do. But towards the end of the meal, my left-leaning friend sits back in her chair and shakes her head, like someone trying to wake from a dream. I don't know, she says suddenly. Is she too good to be true? Jacinda Kate Laurel Ardern was born on the 26th of July, 1980. She has one older sister, Louise, and just before she started school, her family moved to Murupara, an isolated town in the North Island's Bay of Plenty region, infamous during the 1980s for gang violence. Her father, Ross, was the local police sergeant. Her mother, Laurel, worked in the school canteen. It sounds like a dramatic place to be a little kid. Their house was pelted with bottles. The man who lived next door hanged himself. And the family babysitter turned yellow from hepatitis C. Ardern once recalled sneaking barefoot out the back fence and coming unexpectedly upon her dad being confronted by several scary-looking men. "Keep walking, Jacinda. Keep walking," he told her. Reading between the lines, one suspects she was one of those super bright, super nice kids you sometimes come across. A star debater, a school defender of the vulnerable, aged 5, she stood up to kids bullying her older sister, and the underprivileged, those who had no lunch and no shoes. "At home, I was always trying to fix everything," she explains. "I was the peacemaker. I remember hearing my sister packing her bag once to run away and slipping a note under her door begging her not to go. I would have been so irritating." She studied politics and communications at Waikato University and was employed as a staffer in Helen Clark's government in the mid-2000s before a stint in London, where she headed the International Union of Socialist Youth and worked for Tony Blair's Labour machine. When she returned, she entered politics in 2008 as a List MP, an MP appointed by the party as opposed to an electorate. She was 27 years old, the youngest sitting member of Parliament. One of her former teachers, Gregor Fountain, whom she invited to her swearing-in as PM, recalled her amazing ability and curiosity. "I remember her staying behind in class to talk about issues, because she really wanted to grapple with them." At the end of high school, her yearbook contained various "who's most likely" descriptions. Ardern's category? Most likely to be Prime Minister. Her mother and father were major influences, and the family are close, though her scientist sister lives in London, and her parents have been in Niue, a small island nation in the South Pacific, since 2005. Ross Ardern became its High Commissioner in 2014. Ardern was raised a Mormon. Her nana was converted via the classic Mormon door knock, and the rest of the family followed. And even though she left the church many years ago, mostly over the church's rejection of homosexuality, there's been no breach with her family. "I can't separate out who I am from the things that I was raised with," says Ardern. "I took a departure from the theology, but otherwise I have only positive things to say about it." She's retained certain Mormon characteristics. The positivity, the surprising openness, the at times almost painful sincerity. "I'm really earnest," she agrees. "I think it annoys people. I asked a reporter about it once." She laughs. And she said, look, yes, maybe." But if she's earnest, she's also ballsy. And perhaps that's a Mormon legacy too. "I've never had any hesitancy in talking to people," she says. "If I've got a purpose and I need to go and speak to people or knock on doors, I will. I don't mind door knocking for politics," she grins, "because nothing is as hard as door knocking for God." The morning after we meet, I travel to Christchurch with Ardern's entourage, or rather, in front of it. Ardern, who uses commercial domestic flights, boards last at the very back of the plane, and I'm not even sure she's present until I see her after we land. A tall, black-clad figure striding across the tarmac, pulling her wheelie bag, nodding earnestly as an elated-looking air steward talks beside her. Her first meeting is to commit $10 million New Zealand dollars to the restoration of Christchurch Cathedral, damaged by the famous 2011 earthquake. Various officials stand around awkwardly until she arrives and gathers them up with a big embracing motion. "This isn't staged at all, is it?" she jokes cheerfully, as everyone shuffles towards the cameras. She gives a little speech, explaining that the people behind me here have actually done all of the work. She performs this praise-deflecting manoeuvre repeatedly. At Canterbury University later in the day, when an official recalls that she was mobbed by students during her last visit, she immediately corrects him. "I don't think I was mobbed," she says with a smile. "It was raining and I had an umbrella." The next day, when US Vogue publishes a profile piece including a photograph of her looking like a supermodel, she responds by posting a picture on social media of her as a little kid with a full 80s mullet. "It's as if it's impossible for her to take a compliment," I say. "That's actually true," admits Ardern, sounding surprised. "No one's ever said that to me before. I think it's a Kiwi thing." After the cathedral, Ardern's entourage heads 500 metres down the road for the launch of an electric car share company. Off to one side, a small knot of protesters have gathered, holding placards about their seven-year fight over earthquake insurance claims. Megan Woods, the local member, wades in. After a minute, I realise that Ardern, last seen being ushered towards the red carpet, is standing beside her. The protesters seem surprised. Someone called Gary begins to ask a very long question about obstruction and incompetence and the loss of his life savings. "Okay, Gary, that's enough," says someone else, and Gary subsides. Ardern, who has been listening and nodding, says, "What's the best way for us to communicate with you?" Several big trucks roar past and she pauses. "Because there's a long list of stuff we're doing and we want to make sure you hear about it every step of the way." She shakes hands with several protesters who look thrilled, then sets off back to the launch, holding a bag containing another onesie, white this time. Ardern's next function is with the families of the 115 people, 60% of the total death toll, who died when the Christchurch Television CTV building collapsed during the earthquake. Late last year, after 6 years, four investigations and millions of dollars, New Zealand police announced it would not prosecute the building's engineers for negligent manslaughter due to inconclusive and contradictory evidence. The meeting takes place in a church and is closed to journalists, so a big group of us wait in a stiflingly hot anteroom. Someone is playing an organ at high volume close by, a long dirge which seems appropriate to Ardern's words when she emerges. "I felt not only a duty of care to come and speak to the families today," she says, "but also just from a human perspective, I felt it was important, being in the position I'm in, that we do everything in our power to prevent such a tragedy from happening in the future." She goes on to explain that many of the families are taking comfort from the idea of future legislation to allow for prosecution in similar scenarios. But the family's representative, Professor Man Alcasey, who lost his wife, GP Dr. Maysoon Abbas, in the collapse, looks entirely uncomforted when he appears. He wants a judicial review into the police decision and money from the government to support the families in a civil case. "Ardern is a wonderful person," he says, "very sincere. But she is considered to be one of the most influential female politicians in the world. We feel that if she asks for something, she can get it." The CTV case, which one commentator describes to me as a deep, painful open wound in New Zealand, has the potential to become a problem for Ardern, as does the complex rebuilding of Christchurch as a whole. She campaigned on empathy and fairness. But empathy, however sincere, does not heal all wounds. If it leads to false hope, in fact, it can actually make things worse. During parliamentary sitting weeks, Ardern typically spends Monday to Wednesday in Wellington and Thursday visiting a regional area. On Fridays, she heads home to Auckland. The day following her return from Christchurch, I arrive at her home for our interview. Ardern lives in Pointe Chevalier in Auckland, a startlingly normal-looking suburb just beyond the CBD, and her house is a modest, single-storey brick and tile building. It's indistinguishable from others on the street, except that is for the two security guards, one old and one young, who travel everywhere with her. They are standing against a dark fence that looks mostly like a fence you buy at Bunnings and slightly like a fence that could repel a tank attack. Ardern is inside, wearing another shift dress and tights but no shoes. She makes me a lemonade. Homemade, but not by me, she says. And sits on her low grey couch in her bright living room, opposite a TV and a large heap of shoes notionally piled into a basket. Outside, there's a little patch of grass, some hopeful jasmine, and lots of small weeds beside the window. The garden of someone who's rarely home. You must be exhausted, I say. All those events, all that hand-holding and hugging. I like it, she exclaims. Partly it's probably me. I always put my arm around them. During the election campaign, people would say every day, "Can I hug you?" And I'd say, "Of course you can." I think it's wonderful if people think I'm accessible enough that I can do that. I take it only as a compliment. She pauses for a moment. "Of course I do get angry and upset," she says. "Not with the hugging, but I am a normal human." This is slightly surprising. One of Ardern's favourite words is robust, and she often seems to brush off political criticism, not to mention obsessive interest in her personal life, with phrases like, "It was a robust debate," or "I'm pretty robust." So what's her technique for managing stress? Well, if something's bothering me, in order to really work it through, I talk it out a lot. That's my way of processing stuff. Sometimes that means the people around me have to put up with a lot of chat. These things, she goes on, are part and parcel of political life, a life she chose a long time ago. She was handing out Labour leaflets at 17. 3 years earlier, she interviewed Marilyn Waring, a noted feminist, academic, and important young female National Party politician in the 70s, for a school project. "I thought her courage was phenomenal," Ardern recalls. "So I went down to the school canteen where my mum worked and found her phone number. And of course she didn't pick up, and I left this long garbled message as only a 14-year-old could do." A few weeks later, Waring called her back. "What I really remember about Jacinda was that she had specific issues she wanted me to address," recalls Waring, now a professor of public policy at the Auckland University of Technology. "What do you think are the key issues facing my generation? What do you think about a nuclear-free New Zealand?" Today, Waring feels hopeful about Ardern's election and also very relieved. "I can't tell you, my generation has cruelly stuffed it up." Waring was born in 1952. "Whether it's the free market bullshit, the environmental devastation, or the incredible gap between rich and poor. Political transitions have to be dynamic like this. Maybe like Canada, too. Because if you've just got the old boys hanging on, They make sure you never get to prove that they did anything wrong, and so you can never get anywhere. Now that New Zealand has chosen Ardern, let's just hope she can keep being herself and having this lovely candour and enabling us to trust. Politics is a terrible trap. You can't transform it all on your own because the structures all work in such patriarchal Victorian ways, she says. Even for those such as Waring, who have faith in Ardern personally, this is a worrying issue. As pollster David Ferrer says, Labor has so few really good ministers, they've had to load all the really important stuff onto just a few people, and they're struggling. The composition of Ardern's government won't help. Any coalition is inherently unstable, points out Ferrer. The more actors, the greater the potential for disunity. The history of small parties in government in New Zealand is that they've all lost votes in the next election, he explains. The problem is that if you, as a voter, think the government is doing a good job, why wouldn't you choose Labor next time? This is, theoretically, good for Ardern. But small parties can become disruptive and hostile in a bid to avoid destruction, which can make government difficult. In this case, the head of New Zealand First is Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, who has fallen out with just about everyone in every party during his long political career. And though the Greens co-leader James Shaw is a personal friend of Ardern's, his party's vote had already dropped to 5%, which is the cut-off for presence in New Zealand's parliament. In 18 months, says Ferrer, the pressure could really be on. Speaking of pressure, by June, Ardern will not only be PM, but also a mother. She discovered she was pregnant soon after the coalition negotiations, and as is her way, she's already announced lots of plans about what's going to happen and when. She'll take 6 weeks maternity leave, during which Winston Peters will be acting PM. Then she'll return full-time, at which point her partner, Gayford, will become the primary carer. Gayford and Ardern met 4 years ago, when Gayford, belying his knockabout radio DJ come TV fisherman image, contacted her with his concerns about privacy legislation. In his retelling, they met for a coffee, and he discovered, to his amazement, that she liked Concord Dawn, a fantastically awesome New Zealand heavy drum and bass outfit, he says. He took her fishing. She caught a 5.5 kilo snapper. Dolphins and whales frolicked on cue. The rest, as they say, is history. Gayford has previously described his main role as the PM's partner as just to make sure that she's okay and be in the background going, have you eaten your lunch? Have you slept properly? You've got lipstick on your teeth. Perhaps unsurprisingly, he seems unfazed about fatherhood. It's not like we haven't been through a few changes in the past year, he points out genially, speaking on the phone from Wellington. Although I'm lucky, because I get to dip in and out of her world. I still get to bugger off and go fishing, where everything's exactly the same. But then I come home and put on a suit and go to an awards dinner where they announce your name as you come into the room. What has being PM done to their home life? Well, I've been making jokes recently that there's three of us in the relationship now. He laughs. Me, her, and the cabinet papers. And the cabinet papers appear just in time to ruin every weekend. They come in this big security-coded briefcase, and it's my job to go out and get it from the gate on Friday. And I gauge the severity of my weekend based on the weight of that bag. So I walk in, and I stand there, and she looks at me and goes, okay, so what do you think? And then I go, not a good weekend, darling. Early parenthood doesn't lend itself to good weekends either, of course. But one of the unexpected details about Ardern's impending motherhood is that in fact her work scenario is surprisingly baby-friendly, at least on parliamentary sitting days. We've got several newly elected members of parliament who have babies, explains retired Labor Deputy Leader Annette King. And the new Speaker of the House, Trevor Mallard, is called the Baby Whisperer. Whenever there's a baby around, Trevor's got it. It's not unusual to see Mallard, in the Speaker's chair, nursing a baby while overseeing debates. He also apparently has a cot in his office, or members breastfeeding in chamber. Ardern explains that Gayford will bring the baby and travel with her if need be, and that they're open to friends and family helping out. Basically, her plan seems to be to keep doing the job as she does it now. I don't have many choices work-wise, she explains. No one's saying, how would you like your work and home arrangements to be? It just is what it is. So there's no guilt, because if I want to do this job, there's no choice. For all the initial reluctance and the less than ideal preparation and timing, there's no doubt Ardern does want to do this job. I do enjoy it enormously, she says, almost sheepishly, tucking her legs up. It's a job about spending time with people, advocating on their behalf, and making decisions for New Zealand. That's what drove me into politics in the first place. A few days after my visit, Ardern makes a lightning trip to Australia, where I see her at a business lunch with PM Malcolm Turnbull. An unusually ebullient Turnbull starts his speech by telling everyone that Ardern came to his house the previous night for dinner, like a school kid boasting that the popular girl has come to his party. Ardern, in turn, is enthusiastic and charming. She avoids, on this occasion, mention of tensions over university fees and criminal deportations, and makes much of Australia's position as New Zealand's valued trading partner, second only to China, while reassuring us all that our historic trans-Tasman bond is as strong as ever. She also mentions a new domestic policy, a standard of living framework she plans to build into New Zealand's 2019 budget, measuring not only economic, but social success. Yes, balancing the books matters, is how she puts it to me. But so does making sure that your people aren't sleeping in cars and your children aren't living in poverty. She wants environmental and social measures as well as economic ones put in place so that we can understand where our investment and spend is going and the impact of what we're doing. If she pulls it off, Ardern's will be the first government in the OECD to implement well-being economics in a meaningful way. Who knows if she'll achieve this scheme, or any other for that matter? Her story so far reads like a political fairy tale, but other wildly popular leaders, Tony Blair, Barack Obama, even Bob Hawke, all lost support as the realities of power set in. However beloved you are, once you are faced with tough decisions, which have winners and losers, you will inevitably disappoint people. Canada's Justin Trudeau, another charismatic Liberal leader, saw his popularity fall below 50% in 2018 for the first time since his 2015 election. If things don't work out in this bold New Zealand experiment, it won't be Labor or the government that takes the blame. It will be Jacinda Ardern. Time will tell whether she has the political intelligence, endurance, and luck to navigate this. If she has the ability to lead her nation safely through the shoal waters of 21st century politics. Still, in a world in which we're increasingly expected to accept alternative facts, an indefinite strongman rule, and threatening isolationist policies from world leaders, it's nice to be offered something and someone different to believe in. As Ardern puts it, barefoot in her modest house, I don't think too much about the magnitude of the job. I just immediately skip to, let's get the plan going.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes.
My name's Katrina Strickland and I'm the editor of Good Weekend. Joining me today for a discussion about the New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is Amanda Hooton, senior writer with Good Weekend, and Peter Harcher, the political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome, Amanda and Peter.
Thanks, Katrina.
Hi, Katrina.
Amanda, you met Jacinda in early 2018 and she'd been Prime Minister for less than 6 months, I think. Tell us about how you found her.
Well, I think really very much as you would expect from her television appearances and her social media accounts, of which she has many. I think she's just reached the million mark on her Instagram followers. And I think that's compared to Scott Morrison, who I believe has about 100,000, or she's extremely adept at all of that social media. And she is very much, as she appears there, extremely charming, very cheerful, you know, not a skeptic, not a cynic, quite an earnest person in some ways. I think the earnestness comes from her Mormon upbringing, you know, her whole family were raised as Mormons. There's not only an earnestness, but also quite a ballsiness, which I think also comes from that upbringing. She said to me at one point, I don't mind door knocking for politics because it's much, much easier than door knocking for God.
No doubt true.
I'm sure it's true. But, you know, that kind of self-deprecation, she's very good at turning a compliment. You know, the day after she appeared in US Vogue, you know, looking like a supermodel, she then posted on Instagram a picture of her with a full 80s mullet, you know, so that kind of bring herself back to being just like everybody else, which I think is one of her great qualities and one of the things that New Zealanders love about her so much.
And Peter, how common is that kind of, I guess, combination of appearing genuine, having empathy, and being really adept at social media among world leaders?
Oh, that's the trifecta, isn't it? it's not common. You know, as they say, if you can fake authenticity, you've got it made. And most politicians have to work hard to fake the authenticity. Of Jacinda has it naturally, and that's a great advantage.
And is it always, does charisma always serve a politician's, or does it sometimes work against them?
Charisma can contribute to the over hyping or excessive expectation phenomenon. Well, we've seen it in the US. The previous president, Obama, had just glowed with charisma, which created artificial expectations and set him up as a target. And you can never fulfill soaring expectations. We saw it here with two leaders. We saw it with Kevin Rudd and with Malcolm Turnbull, both greeted initially as messiahs, as charismatic leaders. But again, that sets a very high expectation. While Jacinda Ardern has maintained, in fact, she's improved that with time in New Zealand, in the world, it's not worked with the local population among New Zealanders. I couldn't believe the Financial Times, the London city paper that's all about business and economics, recently called her Saint Jacinda. They really got worked up about it. And the Atlantic magazine, just in the last couple of weeks, called her perhaps the most effective leader on earth. While it is a lot easier for people in other countries to see your charisma and to idolise and to project onto you in another country, it's harder for the domestic population. New Zealanders see the problems and not just the charisma. So among New Zealanders, there's been a bit of bafflement about how she could be so sainted and canonised in the rest of the world.
And what's their main gripe? What do they feel that she hasn't done for them?
The economy has been and will be one of the great issues heading into their election in September. The opposition leader has made that point already, that it's okay to laud the government on the COVID handling, but what about the cost? And that's only going to be evident after the restrictions start to ease and as time goes by. So That's going to be her biggest vulnerability. But she's also been criticised on straight-out performance. She promised a major house-building program, Kiwi Build, which was a complete failure and had to be dumped. There are questions about her success in other social progress, for example, numbers of children raised from poverty. So it's nitty-gritty domestic stuff. But of course, if you live in Australia or America or somewhere else, you don't have to worry yourself with the nitty-gritty of daily life in New Zealand. You can just project all your hopes and dreams onto the leader.
It's interesting also that in three years, she's had quite a lot of catastrophes to deal with. She had Christchurch earthquake, then the Christchurch mass shootings, then she had the volcano eruption, and now she's had COVID-19. That played to her strength in kind of the empathy. Perhaps, Amanda, you saw her comforting some people when you were there doing your interview, is that right? How was that to observe?
That's right, actually. Yes, I was down in Christchurch with her. She was there to announce some funding for the rebuilding of the Christchurch Cathedral. And while she was there, a little deputation of people who were still fighting for insurance payouts from the Christchurch earthquake had sort of formed a little posse off to the side. And it was very interesting to watch her, actually, because the officials and her security had sort of cordoned those people off very effectively, and the red carpet was leading, you know, inexorably onwards to the next official sort of engagement. And I was sort of, you know, wandering along at the edges of the red carpet and realised that I'd lost her, and turned to find that she had actually deliberately gone over to that little posse of people and was talking to them. And, you know, they were very emotional, and they were very angry. And she seemed to be completely unfazed by that, and chatted away to them and was, you know, taking down their addresses to send them details and things. And I think this comes back to this ability she has to be very authentic, very comfortable talking to people, very comfortable, in fact, you know, perhaps against her image, very comfortable in dealing with conflict.
Well, could I toss in a couple of thoughts there? In terms of crisis response, I think absolutely she has the empathy. But how's this for practical empathy, not just a hug or an ephemeral smile? She announced a 20% pay cut for herself and her ministers a couple of weeks ago. A 20% pay cut from the Prime Minister is a great way of showing empathy with the suffering of the population, where people have lost jobs, income, businesses. This is a practical form of empathy. I thought Scott Morrison did very well so far as I've noticed. No one's asked him if he's going to take a 20% pay cut. I think he's done well to get away with that. So the empathy thing, she's made real, it's not just an image thing, it's not just a social media thing. She's actually participating in the suffering personally. But the other thing is, it's not just the empathy, it's the decisiveness of her leadership. When things go wrong, when a crisis erupts, and we've seen this, as you said, Katrina, twice, with both the Christchurch massacre and now the virus, she doesn't wait for the focus group results to come in to tell her how she should be responding. She acts in the national interest, and she acts decisively, and she acts quickly. She's empathetic, yes, but she takes the action, and that is what sets her apart. It's the combination of those two attributes.
Amanda, it's interesting, in your piece you said that New Zealanders tend in general to not be as negative about their leaders as Australians.
Yes, look, I'm in danger of falling into, you know, wild generalisations here, right? But it was something that I observed. I don't know if it's something to do with perhaps Australians particularly being extremely sort of cynical and sceptical about their politicians, and also, you know, perhaps in a way slightly apathetic about the political process, you know, even at the best of times. And New Zealanders don't seem to be quite like that. They seem to have a certain level of, you know, optimism and engagement with their politicians that we don't. I mean, I have a friend who lives, actually, oddly enough, very close to Premier House in Wellington. And she can remember as a teenager having her car break down out the front, and Jim Bolger, who was then the Prime Minister, was going for a walk with Joan, his wife, and came along and gave her a push up the hill to get her car going again.
That's great.
And that kind of story, you know, is actually not that uncommon in New Zealand, you know.
Can I make another point, though, about the contrast between trust in leaders in Australia versus New Zealand? I think the Australian political class, it's absolutely right that it's held in much lower regard, much lower esteem, but it's earned that. It's earned the public disdain, and it's earned that through just the depressing internecine warfare. We had a decade of our leaders disappointing every hope and expectation. New Zealand didn't have, to its credit, to the credit of its political class, that same decade, a lost decade of dismal, internecine, egotistical and completely gratuitous political self-indulgence.
It's interesting that she's not come with that big political background. When you look to Australia and you look at people like Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd, even back to John Hewson, the people who came from outside that political process didn't really succeed within it, did they?
That's right, Katrina, in that she came in with a completely clean slate. There was no vendetta against her to begin with. That's a good starting point. She wasn't scheming. She wasn't campaigning. She was elected unanimously the leader of her party. But it's also, I think, that she reacts based on her personal analysis, instincts and feelings, analysis above all there, which is coming, it comes from you rather than you being some sort of objective observer, as if you're outside your own body, waiting for the focus groups and the party research to come in and tell you what the, and this is a very dismissive term that our political leadership uses about citizens and voters, they call them punters, waiting to see what the punters have to say before making a decision. And she just doesn't do that.
No, well, that's true. I mean, she has been a list. She was a list MP in New Zealand. I think she was first entered Parliament at 27. So she has had a fair sort of whack at it. But Peter's absolutely right. I think she is authentic, and the electorate feels that. She said a lovely thing the other day when she was giving her daily briefing and talking about gratitude for frontline workers during the COVID crisis. And she mentioned shop assistants and checkout chicks. And she said, I've been a checkout chick and I know what a thankless task that is. And I think it's that kind of everyman ability to just be like everybody else that is extremely appealing and allows people, I think, to trust her in a way that most of the world simply no longer trusts its politicians.
And there also doesn't seem to be much discussion about Jacinda Ardern as a female prime minister, as a female leader, unlike when we had Julia Gillard as our prime minister. Has the world just moved on from that?
Well, it's true that Jacinda Ardern is New Zealand's third female prime minister. We are still, our tally is still stuck on one. I mean, there is some evidence that it is a sexism problem. But then again, there are countervailing points. For example, there was a Morgan poll in Australia a few weeks ago that looked at most trusted leaders. And in that poll, the first notable result was that the most trusted leader was not an Australian, it was Jacinda Ardern. Among Australian voters, it was Jacinda Ardern as most trusted leader. But the second was not any male politician, it was Penny Wong.
Right.
How interesting.
So there's not a problem with appreciation of female politicians in Australia. And I just remind you that the former deputy, long-serving deputy leader of the Liberal Party and foreign minister of Australia was Julie Bishop, and her public approval ratings were stratospheric. The problem she confronted wasn't the Australian public, it was the Liberal Party room caucus, where in spite of the persistent public appreciation of her manifested in the polling, her colleagues just declined to vote for her. She got it. So I don't know that the Australian public per se has a problem at all with female leaders. And I strongly suspect that when the right candidates and the right time align, we'll have more Australian prime ministers. And we certainly don't have any shortage of Australian female premiers.
Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode of Good Weekend Talks was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance by Conrad Marshall. Technical assistance by Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio. and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.